Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order, and let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:31 p.m. on Thursday, February 2, 2017. Present today, we do have Representative Ortiz, Representative Pruitt, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, myself, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Tilton, Representative Wren, and Co-Chair Seaton. Representative Thompson has been previously excused from today's meeting. Before we start, please do mute your cell phones. And just a reminder that for the presenters to please avoid using acronyms if at all possible. And on today's schedule, we are going to hear the introduction of HB 61, the Governor's Permanent Fund Protection Act. And I'd like to also recognize that we have with us Representative Guttenberg. And here to present on House Bill 61 are Randy Hoffbeck, the Commissioner of Revenue, and also Emma Pokin, the Special Assistant, Department of Law. And Mr. Hoffbeck, Ms. Pokin, please place yourselves on the record and proceed with your presentation.
Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue.
Emma Pokin, the Department of Law.
Thank you, Chairman Foster, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to address the governor's, the key part of the governor's fiscal plan, the Permanent Fund Protection Act, that's going to be critical to the long-term fiscal stability for the state of Alaska. I have with me Emma Pokin from the Department of Law. Typically, we wouldn't have someone from the AG's office sitting up here as part of the presentation, but Emma's taken on kind of a multifaceted role in this, and that she's she was involved in the development of the plan. She's also been coordinating a lot of the modeling of the plan, not modeling it herself, but working with the numbers person. She's kind of been the bridge between the numbers and the words. And so she's intimately familiar with the plan, and will be somebody that, as we're walking the halls and talking to people, you'll be likely to see Emma as the person that will be bringing the resources around. There's also two companion documents that have been distributed, I think, 2 days ago. One is a white paper called the Alaska Permanent Fund and the Permanent Fund Protection Act. It's about an 11 or 12 page document that really goes over most everything that we're going to discuss today. And there's also a document on the Permanent Fund Protection Act, the one page summary that's also been distributed and is available concerning this particular bill. The basic elements of the bill are really twofold. It provides a framework for sustainable draws from the earnings reserve account, permanent fund earnings reserve account, and a sustainable dividend formula. The sustainable draw from the earnings reserve is as I said, a key component of the governor's plan. The modeling itself is, you know, largely a numbers-driven process on maximizing the amount of money that we could make available through a restructuring of the permanent fund for using for providing government services. And the sustainable dividend formula, again, is largely numbers-driven, but is the kind of the motivating factor behind that is public expectation that is any part of any plan that there would be a protection of the dividend as well as any use of the fund. Both need to be accounted for in any final version of any plan. The just quick overview of the presentation. We'll first discuss the problem, really kind of the why do we need to do this now. Why is this so critical at this point in time? Well, then spend some time just kind of reviewing the permanent fund structure itself so people understand why there's certain components within the bill and why they're necessary. Then we'll talk about the permanent fund's role in the solution, kind of tying the problem and the solution together, and then finish up with a review of the bill itself and a brief sectional analysis and just really how to show how the components meet the stated goals and objectives of the bill. So what is the problem that we're facing right now? And it really is threefold. It's a low oil revenues, persistent deficit, and because of the persistent deficit, diminished budget reserves, diminished savings. And I want to talk talk a little bit about why that low oil revenues issue is important. From 2014 to 2017, we've been in an environment that people have classified as a low oil price environment. But I think we need to, and there have been some times where we've had some really low oil prices. A year ago at this time, we were in the mid-20s on our oil price. But but I think we need to really look at that as more the new norm than that this is a low oil price environment. I think most of the pundits that forecast oil price going forward look at that $55 to $60 price range as kind of a stabilized range for prices. And so I think we need to kind of shift our expectations on what is actually possible in what we can achieve from oil and gas tax and royalty revenue. And when you look at that, it shows that we need another significant source of revenue so that we don't have a persistent deficit and we don't continue to draw down on our savings, on our budget reserves. The low oil revenue is, the significance of it is that from 2005 to 2014, oil revenues were about 90% of the state's budget. And from 2012 to 2015, oil prices fell 88%. So you've got 90% in your budget that lost 88% of its value. You know, simple math, 90% times 88%, you've lost approximately 80% of your revenues for the state of Alaska. And as I said, as we look forward, we don't really see a scenario where that rebounds very heavily. And so we're looking at a long-term structural deficit that needs to be resolved. The net impact of the lower oil prices is simply that even though we've cut 44% out of our budget since 2013, we're still in a deficit budget situation. Deficit, and it's not really deficit spending. We can't deficit spend, but what we've done is we've used our savings to cover the deficit. And we're at a point now where we've really only got one more year of that savings available before we simply cannot fund our budget that way anymore. And you can see from this chart, the blue dashed line is the unrestricted general fund budget. And you can see that's come down dramatically since 2013. But the yellow line being our revenue has come down even more. And the red bars are, they just kind of represent the deficit that we've been covering with savings. Deficit is the revenues from oil has dropped for really two specific reasons. One is price, the other is production. We simply don't have the price that we used to have, and we don't have, we've only got about 25% of what our peak production was. And so we've got low price, low production, low revenues. And the reality is that that long before we run out of the deficit, we're going to run out of savings. This points to the diminished budget reserves that back in 2013 we had about $16.3 billion in the combined statutory budget reserve and constitutional budget reserve. That's down to at the beginning, or at the end of fiscal year 17 we'll be at $4.6 billion. By the end of fiscal year 18 we'll be at $2.1 billion. $2.1 billion is not enough to cover the deficit going into 2019. So this would be the last budget year where that could be filled using just simply savings, and then we would be standing with our feet totally off the cliff looking at what do we do next. So we need to come up with another solution. We're basically at the point where we've got to decide what we do moving forward, because the status quo, just simply, we've run out of time with the status quo. And that $2.1 billion, even though it would be a substantial part of any deficit in fiscal year 19, the reality is we really need to save some money in the CBR. We need to have money for unexpected expenditures. We need to have money for if we get an interruption in oil and gas revenue where it doesn't meet the budgetary expectations in a given year. And frankly, we need it as our liquidity bank for any program moving forward that uses the permanent fund for funding government services. We need a way to pay the bills on a daily basis, and the best way to do that is to use the CBR as the liquidity portion that then the permanent fund pays, or permanent fund earnings reserve that we appropriate would then be used to pay that back as those are, as the gains are realized. That way we don't put the permanent fund in a situation of having to realize gains artificially to cover cash draws and create a situation where they would not be managing the permanent fund as efficiently as they should. So once the budget reserves are depleted, the only place to turn is the permanent fund. And facing that reality, the question really becomes how. How do we do that? How is the best way to solve this fiscal crisis in a way that makes good sense, that makes good sense as a good sustainable draw and creates a good sustainable dividend? And that's really the equation that we're trying to solve with this particular bill. Just real quickly on the structure of the permanent fund, it's really made up of two parts, the principal and the earnings reserve account. The principal really has two components to it, the corpus. The corpus of the principal is the part that can't be spent. It's the part that that's where the royalties have gone into over the years. That's where inflation proofing has been deposited back in. So within the principal fund, you've got about $39.4 billion within the corpus of the fund, and another $4.7 billion that's unrealized gains. And because they're unrealized, they have not moved over to the earnings reserve yet at this point in time. And then you've got the earnings reserve account that has about $8.6 billion in it. And the earnings reserve is the portion that is available for appropriation and expenditure. Just graphically, how the money flows in and out of the permanent fund. Under the Constitution, 25% of all mineral royalties go into the corpus of the fund. That number is actually larger than 25% right now because there were statutory provisions that newer fields paid 50% into the fund. So the weighted average is about 30% of all mineral royalties go into the principal of the fund right now. From the principal of fund, there's something called statutory net income. It's realized gains. It's the monies from dividends, from fixed incomes that mature and are cashed out. It's from equities that are sold. It's from real estate investments where, you know, we get rent or royalties. Everything that generates cash on an annual basis, these realized gains, that flows out of the principal of fund and into the earnings reserve account. And there's about $3 billion a year that flows into the earnings reserve account. And then from that earnings reserve account, we take the five-year average. And we take 5 years and take it times 21%, so it's just slightly more than the five-year average. And that's how much is available for appropriation in a given year. Half of that goes to pay the dividend, and the other half is used to inflation-proof the principal of the fund. And everything else that's left over stays within the earnings reserve account. That's kind of the status quo process. And over the years, that's built that fund up to that $8.6 billion. If we look at how much is being generated on an annual basis from the statutory net income, and we compare that to the revenues that we're receiving from our other sources, you see that over the last 3 years, the money's being generated by the permanent fund far exceed the amount of monies that we're receiving from oil and gas tax revenue plus all other unrestricted revenues. And that's the future of the fund. With low prices, with this kind of stabilized $60 oil price and about 500,000 barrels a day in production, it's unlikely that we're going to see anything except maybe a few anomalous years where oil price will exceed the earnings from the permanent fund. The permanent fund is our largest asset at this point in time and will be going forward. So the problem is that if we just simply spend down the CBR and then switch to the earnings reserve and spend that in a similar fashion, just ad hoc spending to fill the gap with no real structural change to how we fund government, if we don't reduce spending, if we don't increase other revenue sources, and we just spend the permanent fund like we did the CBR, that by 2022 or 2023, there won't be any money in the earnings reserve anymore. When there's no money in the earnings reserve, there's no dividend. when there's no money in the earnings reserve. There's no additional way to fund government services other than just the pure oil and gas revenues and other tax revenues. And we create a situation where we really not only hamstring government and create a situation where we can't pay the bills, we also create a situation where we can't pay the dividend. And so we need something more forward-looking than just going in and just starting to spend the money on a yearly basis. To put in perspective just how important the permanent fund is to solving the problem, and this isn't a proposed solution. This is just kind of the relative importance of the various solutions that are proposed. Some of them on the table, some are just still being discussed, but how the permanent fund relates to those. The current budget, unrestricted general fund budget, is about $4.2 billion, which creates about a $2.8 billion budget gap, because we only have about $1.4 billion in oil and gas taxes and royalties and other revenues. So we've got this $2.8 billion gap. Some of the issues that are items that are out there right now, some in play, as I said, some are just being discussed. Motor fuel tax increase, and these are rounded to the nearest $100 million, would only bring in about $100 million when fully implemented. It's actually about $80 million. Other broad-based taxes, either income tax or sales tax, are projected to bring in kind of on the maximum level about $600 million. The corporate income tax adjustment, both for adjusting the upper bracket in the tax and also bringing in the S-Corps, LLCs, and partnerships, would bring in about $100 million. Oil tax credit reform would be about $100 million a year. And then the maximum kind of discussion, the Senate's discussion on proposed cuts is $750 million a year. If you add all of those up, if you did absolutely everything that's been out there discussed, you got $1.65 billion to solve a $2.8 billion hole. And so you need something big. You need something big enough to generate not tens of millions or hundreds of millions. You need something that's capable of generating billions. And the only thing that's capable of doing that is the permanent fund earnings. So, you know, we've got tens of million dollar solution. We've got a couple of hundreds of millions of dollar solution. We've only got $1 billion solution, and that's the permanent fund earnings.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on the last slide, could you please be a little clearer about bills that we, which ones of these will take bills that we currently have or which ones that may be coming? Because I don't know, on the corporate income tax, are you talking about a proposed bill or where we're at right now on the corporate income tax? Are you talking about a new oil tax credit reform, or are you talking about something that we did last year that's going to bring those funds in? I know motor fuels tax increase. I know that's new and there's a bill out there for that, but I don't know whether or not there's something we're waiting for something to come out, or that's money that we bring in those right now.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I'll walk right through them. Of course, the motor fuel tax increase, that bill is in play. It's been heard in the House, and I think it's being heard in the Senate or vice versa, actually right now. The other broad-based tax, there's no bill that's in play, but there's been several income tax bills that have been discussed that are in about that price range. Corporate income tax, that's a bill that the governor has prepared. Representative Guerra has one that deals with the S-Corps, the LLCs, and the partnerships. And oil gas tax credit reform, that's really based more on the last bill that came out in the special session last year. As I understand it, the House is talking about introducing a bill sometime in the next week or two. They're holding the hearings right now on oil and gas tax and credit reform. But the numbers really driven by some modeling from bills from last year. And then the cuts that are proposed, that's the Senate's number of $750 million over 3 years, with about $300 million in the first year. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Moving to slide 17, there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, what the permanent fund was established for. People look at the statutory language. They looked at the legislative intent. They've looked at they've listened to what people that were involved in the creation of the fund remembered as the intent. But I thought probably the best thing to look through is just look at the ballot initiative that established the constitutional amendment for the permanent fund. And it says, this proposal, if approved, would amend the Constitution of the State of Alaska by establishing a constitutional permanent fund into which at least 25% of all mineral royalties received by the state would be paid. The principal of the fund would be used only for income-producing investments, so that's the corpus part that's protected, would only be used for generating, for income-producing investments permitted by law, and the income from the fund would be deposited in the general fund of the state and be available to be appropriated for expenditure by the state, unless otherwise provided by law. Of course, that otherwise provided by law is the portion that created the dividend program a few years later. But if you look at the language in the Constitution itself, that part about expenditure by the state doesn't reside in the language within the Constitution, but yet it was part of the actual ballot measure that was passed. And so that was critical to go back and just look at what it was that the public actually voted on when they voted on that constitutional amendment. And it clearly states that that the money was anticipated to be available for appropriation for state expenditures.
I'd like to recognize that we have with us Representative Kawasaki.
Slide 18. So there's really some items that we need to have in mind as we judge the sufficiency of any plan for restructuring the permanent fund and how it should be used. Certainly the fund was established as a multi-generational fund, so any solution has to be a long-term solution. It has to work for all generations. It can't just work for us now. It needs to be something that's going to maintain the fund for our children and our grandchildren and their children and on and on and on. That really needs to be part and parcel of the solution. Kind of on that same vein, it needs to be sustainable. And to be sustainable in a long-term solution, any plan has to maintain or grow the real value of the permanent fund. It needs to grow with at least inflation, so that the buying power of the fund doesn't degrade over time. So we need to make sure that whatever plan we have allows for the corpus of the fund to grow at least at the rate of inflation, and hopefully at a rate greater than that, and increase the value of the fund over time. It needs to provide for a dividend. The public has made that very clear, that it needs to be able to provide for a dividend. And it also needs to, as long as you're using the earnings reserve as your conduit for the availability of cash for appropriation, you have to make sure that the earnings reserve account is large enough to bridge years where you may have low earnings. So there needs to be enough money in that to keep for it to be sustainable. And the second thing is,
we got a question from Representative Glenn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, if we start using the earnings reserve for government, is there an investment philosophy change from the permanent from the corporation, more aggressive, less aggressive than what they do now? Would that
through the chair, Representative Grant, the modeling that we have done doesn't assume any change in the fund management or the allocation of investments. That we aren't asking the permanent fund to be more aggressive to cover greater draw, because right now the draw is essentially limited to the dividend, because the other large draw each year goes right back into the corpus as inflation proofing. So really the only outflow was the dividend. So what we're talking about now is something probably twice that size in any given year. So the question is, does that mean that do they need to realize more gains or carry more in cash? And I think that we'll be able to work out a plan using the CBR as kind of the cash sink that we need for daily expenditures, and then allow the permanent fund to essentially operate as they always have. And as they realize the gains, they would be transferred to the Department of Revenue to pay back the CBR. Right now, the projections by the Permanent Fund Corporation show that they realize about 90% of their earnings every year. So, of their total earnings, about 90% of them are realized. If that's the case, they should be realizing more than enough on an annual basis to cover the cash draw for funding government services and paying the dividend without having to change their structure. Well, that's something that once a plan's in place, we know the full structure and how big the draw is, we will sit down with the permanent fund and come up with a plan so that we have sufficient cash management for paying the bills, but we don't duplicate liquidity on the revenue side and unnecessarily on the permanent fund side.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Slide 20, any plan needs to be rule-based. It really needs to have structure around it, and it needs to have rules for saving, for spending, and for paying the dividend. That's the only way that it can be designed to protect and guard against unsustainable uses. It's the only way that you need to, we need a good, solid set of rules in the statutes, and I guess more or less a commitment to follow those rules in order for us to maximize the use without jeopardizing the corpus of the fund. And the legislature, I mean, the permanent fund's been driven by a rule-based process for the last 30 years with the dividend, and the legislature has always followed that rule. And so I think there's every expectation that once the fund is restructured and the new rules are in place, that the legislature will follow those rules as well. But it's absolutely critical to have a rule for savings, for spending, and for the dividend. We'll talk about each of those a little bit more slides later as we move forward. And that really is international best practice as well. Slide 21, there's nothing really significant about this as it relates to what we're going to do, but it just lists three different funds that have developed a rule-based framework, the Singapore Fund, Kazakhstan, and Norway. And if you read them, they're a very different set of rules. And I think the message to take from that is that there's a lot of ways to create a rule-based structure that works, and that structure is largely driven by the needs of the entity that are developing the rules. And so Singapore did a 20-year model, figured out what the average annual draw would be over 20 years, and allowed themselves to take 50% of that annual average each year. Kazakhstan had an $8 billion draw that could adjust by 15%, but if the fund dropped to a low level, it would correct, it would adjust. And Norway is just a 4% draw. And so there's a lot of different ways that can be structured. And so when we put this one forward, we're putting it forward as the plan that we think best meets the needs of the state of Alaska. But as we said last year, we're open to modifications and adjustments as long as they meet the needs. And if you remember last year, the governor originally proposed a $3.3 billion fixed draw with all the money flowing through the permanent fund. And people said, no, that's too tight, that's too constrained, that doesn't give us enough flexibility. And ultimately, what we see now is what was substituted by the Senate for the plan, and it works. So.
We've got a question from Representative Guerra.
Hi, Commissioner. Can you go back to page 13 for a second? It's sort of relevant to the whole presentation, but I'm able to ask it now. So you're proposing a 5.25% draw on the value of the permanent fund, and that's effectively like a 4.8% draw. I get that. And I'll just admit that I've been looking at this also, as folks know from committee last year, and other folks are looking at it. And we're all using, should it be a 4.25% draw? Should it be a 5.25% draw? And honestly, no matter what number we choose, if you look at this in 2009, if we had a bunch of years like 2009, we're just going to have to admit none of our formulas are going to work that year, and we're just going to have to deal with it that year, right? I mean, do you concede that whether we pick 5.25 or 4.5, no matter what those numbers are, if we have a bunch of catastrophic years and the earnings reserve, we're just going to have to figure it out because none of those formulas are going to work that year, right? And then, what in those years? Let me ask you: is that a fair statement?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, it's a fair statement with the assumption that we would get multiple catastrophic years like that in a row. That isn't the history of the market, that you get multiple catastrophic years in a row. So they tend to be anomalies within the system. And because we've got a provision we'll talk about a little bit later, that every 3 years we go back and review, we've got a safety net where we could go back in and say, okay, we're depleting this, and there's no reason that the legislature couldn't say we want to review quicker than that if things really started to spin out of control. Yeah, we can't guard against, you know, 3 or 4 years of catastrophic returns in any plan, but I think that would be to create a structure to deal with that, I think would not maximize the use of the fund.
Hello?
Yeah, Commissioner, and I'm not criticizing you. That's just the reality you're dealing with. So I don't mean to criticize you, and I'm dealing with the same reality. Everybody has got an idea out there. But given the way the earnings reserve works, which is it's just the realized earnings, it's not really the actual growth of the permanent fund, no matter what, you know, whether we move the draw by 0.25% here or there, if we have bad years in earnings reserve returns, net earnings, we're just going to have a problem. We'll have to deal with it. I don't want to shine anybody on. If I have a proposal, I don't want to shine anybody on. I probably will have a proposal. I mean, fair enough?
Fair enough.
Okay.
Sorry, through the chair.
Fair enough. Please proceed.
Going to slide 22. Kind of point four on what we need in any system is that it needs to be stabilizing. It needs to take the volatility out of the system as much as it possibly can. And you're looking at the graph. You can see that on the yellow bar is the unrestricted general fund revenue, and the dashed line is the unrestricted general fund budget. And you can just see the volatility, particularly in this case that I'm pointing to, is the revenue side of that equation. And I mean, when you've got a budget revenue in FY7-8 time frame of $11 billion, and by FY16 you've got revenues of about $1 billion, and you've got to figure out how to deal with $10 billion less in revenue than you had just, you know, 10 years before, that's a very difficult proposition. So to the extent that we can use the structure, restructuring the permanent fund to flatten out some of that volatility, I think that's a desirable result and something that we should seek in any plan that's put forward. And not only does it the volatility really impact our ability to budget efficiently from the government side, but that volatility has shown to create slower economic growth within the market as well, and particularly as our government spending bleeds out into the market in inconsistent patterns. You know, we've got kind of the worst of both worlds. We've got almost 100% reliance on a commodity, and there's nothing much more volatile than commodity prices, and that creates a situation where we've just had a tremendous amount of volatility. Now, returns are volatile too, but we can account for some of that with using a 5-year look back and averaging of returns, and then there's also a draw component that we can use that we'll talk about in a few slides. And then finally, the one that I mentioned to Representative Guerra's question is that we really need to maximize the use of the permanent fund earnings. If we leave money on the table from the permanent fund earnings by being too cautious in the plan, we really make the hard choices to fill the rest of the gap even harder. And so the modeling mantra or the modeling goal when we looked at how to restructure the permanent fund was to squeeze as many dollars out of it as we could in order to fill as much of the gap as possible. And even doing that, we're still looking at somewhere between $700 million and $1 billion that we still need to fill, even maximizing the use of the permanent fund. And so there's a lot of work to be done still. And so leaving money on the table that we wouldn't necessarily have to, I think, is not it's not using the fund to its fullest potential, not getting us to the finish line as easily as we could. So the tests really for any plan that would come out is needs to be long-term, needs to be sustainable, it needs to be rule-based, it needs to be stabilizing, and it needs to maximize the use of the fund. So with those rules in mind, let's take a look at the talk a little bit more specifically about the Permanent Fund Protection Act itself. I did want to talk about a little bit about just the number of hearings that have been involved in, and actually the development of the plan that's before you, because it's essentially last year's plan that passed the Senate, stripped down to take some extra things out that were added to it, but it's really the result of the hearing process from last year. And if you look at it with SB 128, which is the bill that passed the Senate, HB 245, which was kind of the companion bill within the House, and then SB 5001, which was what was introduced in the special session, there were 39 hearings on this bill, plus 7 days of public testimony. If you add to that hearings on other bills associated with the permanent fund last year, SB 114, which was Senator McGuire's bill, and 7 hearings in Senate State Affairs, and 9 hearings in Senate Finance, so 16 hearings on that bill. And ultimately, that was the bill that really got plugged in to the governor's plan. I kind of plucked out the heart of the governor's plan and plugged that one in, because the Senate felt like that was what they were more comfortable with. So those were, you know, so those were bills that are hearings that all kind of resulted in drilling down to what we have now. We had HB 303, Representative Millett's bill, that had 4 hearings, and that was the companion bill to SB 114. And then we had Representative Hawker's bill, HB 224, which was an alternative plan that also had 4 hearings. So there's 63 hearings in all on how to restructure the Permanent Fund Protection Act last year. Now, some of those are duplicates. Some of those bills were multiple bills were heard in one hearing. We didn't go back and try and dissect it quite to that fine tune, but suffice to say, there was a substantial amount of effort put into developing what ultimately passed the Senate.
We've got a question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in my view, in order to pass a fiscal plan this year, we're going to have to cut down some of the rhetoric. And to help me do that, would you be able to get us, based on the fall forecast of your fall forecast, what the projected future permanent fund dividends would be under each of these plans that you have on page 25?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, we can, in combination with the permanent funds forecast, we can get you that number.
Yeah, through the chair.
That'll
be useful. It's going to help us debate this thing on policy instead of whose dividend is the smallest or biggest.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, actually some modeling that we have prepared to present tomorrow actually has dividend forecasts in it. So, and that is based on Department of Revenue modeling using permanent fund assumptions. So,
we have a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So can you tell me why you removed the last three that you have? There's ZBR management, APFC procurement, and the spending cap?
Through the chair, Representative Walton, yes, I was just about to get there.
You were.
So there were 3 components that we removed from the bill, none of which were part of the restructuring of the permanent fund. They were actually items that were added under the title, but really were not really even part of the permanent fund restructure. The one was moving the CBR management from the Department of Revenue to the Permanent Fund Corporation. There was concern that the CBR wasn't generating great enough returns, and that the permanent fund could generate higher returns if the CBR was moved over there. There was a study done this summer that looked at that and said it really it's inconsequential whether it sits in revenue or within the permanent fund. The results will be similar, the costs will be similar. The reason that it's earning less in the Department of Revenue right now than what actually last year earned more because the market was so bad and it was in a safer category, but this year it's earning less, is because it needed to be set aside in a safe and liquid fashion because it was going to have to be spent for government services. If it was sitting over in the permanent fund, they would have those same restrictions. And so that it really didn't matter where it sat as long as those restrictions were necessary in order for the use of that fund. And so we pulled that out. It also has another benefit is that one of the things that the permanent fund is not set up for is cash management on a daily basis, because they make one draw or one There's one draw on the fund every year, and that's to pay the into the earnings reserve the statutory net income. Within the Department of Revenue, we have to pay bills every day, and so we've got a pretty sophisticated cash management system in place. If you were to move the CBR over to the permanent fund, and then require the permanent fund to absorb that cash management responsibility in order to make sure that there's money flowing back over to the Department of Revenue and Department of Administration to pay the bills, they would have to recreate that structure within the Permanent Fund Corporation, which doesn't exist there right now. And so there was no real necessity to move it there. I think there was a desire from some to move it there, but I think as we looked at it over the summer, it just really makes more sense to live in the Department of Revenue. And once we have a fiscal plan in place, it can be invested much more aggressively and achieve returns similar to what it would be if it was sitting within the corpus of, or within the totality of the Permanent Fund Corporation. So that was that one. The Permanent Fund Corporation procurement, that was stripped out in the House last year, and really is, I mean, we had, Department of Revenue agrees that the permanent fund should have that procurement exemption. So it's not an issue of whether we think it should or shouldn't be there. We just don't think it needs to be in this particular bill. And then the spending cap, which was something that was added in Senate Finance last year. But the spending cap really dealt with issues other than oil and gas revenues, and the permanent fund, it dealt with spending cap on other revenues that were that came into the unrestricted general fund, and so it really wasn't. It didn't impact the restructuring the permanent fund, but really was a broader cap for all government spending, and we felt that was more appropriate to be heard outside of the permanent fund bill. So.
And a follow up, Mr. Chairman. Personally, I think the spending cap is probably one of the most important parts of having a bill at this time, so that we're looking at both. But just with the bill itself, so we're able to use the earnings reserve right now with a vote of 21, and we could put a POMV, a percent of market value, in it. I'm trying to learn the rules myself, and be able to utilize the part that's not paid for dividends. So why just using with the structure that is currently in place, that you felt that going to making all these other changes couldn't get us to the same place as if we had just utilized the same system we have currently, with maybe a check in place so that we couldn't spend any amount of the earnings reserve, but it would actually be a set amount?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, if you can wait a couple of slides, we kind of walk through what that.
I can wait.
Why we did it that way.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
You got a question from Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, I want to follow up on this particular issue, especially the your conversation about the cash management from the CBR, then it really piqued me, not because of should the CBR be invested by the permanent fund, but really in terms of how we are going to proceed going forward, recognizing that under this legislation, the intent is that a certain amount of money will be going towards government. Is the intent that we will just cash out once, just like we do now, and money will be moved and you will then manage that cash? Or are we going to have some sort of cash management take place with the earnings reserve money that will be utilized for state government?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the idea is to create a structure where we have cash as needed and not have a large pool of cash that because of a one-time deposit that moved over to the Department of Revenue. And so the idea would be there's provisions within the law where we can borrow from the CBR during the year as long as we pay it back by the end of the fiscal year. And so the idea would be that the CBR could be the liquidity bank, that the Department of Revenue could borrow money to meet cash calls from the CBR if there hadn't been money coming over from the permanent fund. And then we would pay that back when the permanent fund realized gains and transferred the money to the Department of Revenue. So it's a structure we're going to have to develop. But I think that we can develop a structure where we can use the CBR as it for liquidity and not have to duplicate it over on the permanent fund side, because as soon as they have to carry any extra liquidity, that reduces their returns as well. So the CBR is going to be, because it's going to be the liquidity portion, there's a portion of that's not going to have great returns, but we would limit that to just the minimum amount that we need for in a given year, and then take the rest of it and invest it more aggressively.
So then just follow up on that. So, I mean, so in your mindset, it almost sounds like, though, we potentially could ask them to manage the CBR, which was, I think, the concept last year, but, as long as we continued to pay it back. But is there more of a, you want to ensure that Department of Revenue really maintains their control of that money, or is it, again, to the, because I think you had highlighted earlier, that you didn't feel that it would have any difference in earning potential over with the permanent fund because of that other provision that states that it has to be liquid. And I guess I would, and I'd finish with that, is that a statutory provision, or is that a constitutional provision that I may have missed in some way?
To the chair, Representative Pruitt, right now we can enter an MOU with the permanent fund to manage the CBR with or without legislative action. So there's nothing that precludes us from doing that. It's just simply we've got a fairly robust cash management system, and we roll through about $400 million a month. That you know we try and only have liquid as short a period of time as possible, and if you move the CBR over to the permanent fund, they're going to have to establish some process for doing that as well, to make sure that when we need the money, they've got it available. And so it's just a simpler process to leave it where it's at.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please proceed.
So moving to slide 26, really the kind of the bill summary, and then we'll talk about each one of these 3 points individually. So there's 2 components to the sustainable draw. We've talked about each of them briefly so far. One is the 5.25% of market value draw. The second is a draw limit, which is tied to the oil and gas taxes and royalties, and when it starts to shut off the monies coming from the permanent fund, when oil and gas taxes and royalties increase to a point where the monies aren't needed anymore. The permanent fund monies aren't needed anymore. The second piece is the sustainable dividend formula, which under the bill that passed the Senate last year was 20% of the unrestricted general fund royalties and 20% of the percent of market value would go to pay the dividend. And then finally, adjustment to the deposits to the corpus, that we would, it reduces the royalties back to just the constitutional mandate at 25%, and inflation proofing becomes what we call a 4x draw process, which we'll discuss in a couple of slides. Slide 27 then is kind of the comparison to the slide we had earlier that showed the current system. This would be the system under the Permanent Fund Protection Act. Or you'd have 25. Oh, I'm sorry.
All right, we've got a quick question here from Representative Co-Chair Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On slide 26, we have a sustainable draw formula of 5.25%, and yet in your paper on the Permanent Fund and Permanent Fund Protection Act, that paper on slide 4, it says the board, that's the Board of Trustees, long-term investment goal, average real return after accounting for inflation rate, a return of 5%. Would you go ahead and explain the difference between the board-established 5% on page 4 of the document as a long-term goal and the draw of 5.25?
Through the chair, Representative Co-Chair Seaton, if we could wait till slide 28. We've got a slide that I think will explain how we rectify that.
We've got another question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Commissioner, this is going to come up a bunch of times, so maybe we'll address it once. So constitutionally, we're required to put 25% of our royalties into the Constitution. And then at one point, when we had extra money, we increased that for new fields for just the new fields to 50%, but then Representative Roepberg filed a bill that passed to reduce it back to 25%, but something happened with that. So how did that not work? Like, why? What was the bill passed by Representative Roepberg? I think the intention was to reduce it back to 25%, but...
Through the chair, Representative Garab. That particular bill had a trigger on it that when calculated that the reduction in the draw or the reduction in the deposit into the corpus of the fund reduced an individual's dividend by, I think it was like $7 or something. It was a fairly low number, that it would shut back off again and go back to the larger deposit. So it had an automatic trigger in it that shut it off after a few years.
Thanks.
Please proceed.
So back on slide 27, so we've got 25% of the royalties going into the principal of the fund. As with the current structure, statutory net income is the way that money moves from the principal of the fund into the earnings reserve account. The earnings reserve now, rather than paying directly to a dividend fund, would pay into the general fund, making it available for appropriation. And under the 2020 formula, 20% of the value of the percent of market value draw and 20% of the dividends outside of the monies that go into the corpus would create the dividend. That much would come out of the general fund and go into the dividend fund. So it flows through the general fund and into the dividend fund instead of directly into the dividend fund. And then the other difference is that whereas on the prior slide there was a just a inflation-proofing transfer from the earnings reserve back into the principal, we now have a four-times draw structure, and we'll talk about that in a couple of slides instead of trying to get too far ahead. But those are the significant differences in the current structure versus the structure that we're proposing. And the reason that we tried to limit the number of changes as much as possible was to give some confidence to the public and those that were reviewing the plan of its durability and its protection of the fund. Because obviously one of the concerns was that, and you hear it in the letters to the editor and on talk radio, that once the legislature gets their fingers into the fund, or once the governor gets his hands on the fund, they're just going to spend it all. And so what we did is we tried to leave as much of the structure that protected the fund under the status quo in place to give some comfort that that the fund would be protected under the new plan as well. Slide 28 now talks about how that 5.25% draw works. And it's actually 5.25% of the first five of the last 6 years. So you go back 6 years and you take year 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 of those 6 years and you average those, and that tells you what your fund value is to take the 5.25% draw against. So in this particular case, in using 2012 to 2017, the values of the fund, you'd use 2012 to 16 as the first 5 years. And that gives you a $48.1 billion average fund balance. So 5.25% of that is $2.5 billion. That would be available for paying the dividend and for paying paying for government expenditures.
We got a question from Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. It took me a second to realize what you're doing with the first five of the last six, but what is the philosophy of skipping that first year and going back to the next five?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, it's because we wanted to have absolute certainty on how much money was available when the budget process started, and that last year won't be closed out and fully audited in time for us before the budget started to know exactly what that number was. And so if we just step back one more year with the five-year average, we have an absolute calculatable number of what the monies that would be available for budgeting. So it's just to give us a little bit more of a lockdown on the number.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Going back then, and this is to answer Representative Seaton's question about the 5%, the draw, then if you actually looked at how much that $2.5 billion draw against the fund value in 2017, which when the board talks about a draw, it's a draw against earnings against the current year. So if you looked at what that $2.5 billion was against the current year value, it equates to a 4.7% draw against the current year value. So although we talk about 5.25% against the five-year average, if you actually roll it forward and apply it against the current year, it bounces around between 4.5% and 5%, depending upon the how much the fund has grown over those that five-year period of time. And so as long as the fund is increasing in value, and we hope that it continues to increase in value over time, that 5.25% draw will always be something less than 5.25% and should be less than 5%. We admit it's aggressive. I mean, we modeled this to extract as much money as we can, but we think if the next step, the draw limit is applied, that in fact it is sustainable, and the modeling shows that it's sustainable over the long haul. Before we get to the draw limit, though, I want to talk a little bit, and this goes to Representative Wilson's question on why we just don't put a POMV in place
Maybe before you move on to this next slide, we've got a question from Representative Ortiz.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, he may be explaining it, so I'll hold off my question here for 1 minute. Okay.
Sure. So the idea is, what would happen if we just simply had a POMV draw and just added it onto the revenue that we're currently achieving? And so looking at this chart, and this chart sometimes gets hard to read because we always think of these charts as being a time series, but this one's not a time series. This is a dollar series, and so the bottom line on the chart is oil price. And so we can kind of see the impact of oil price on revenues at any given oil price. And so what this shows is that, if we're in the $55 to $60 range where we're at right now, we need the full earnings reserve draw in order to get up to that high $3 billion, $3.37 billion mark, somewhere in there, $3.6, in order to close that gap enough that then with other cuts or other revenues we can close the rest of the gap. But if we get up into $95, $100, $105 oil, now we don't really need that entire POMV draw, and so we need some way to start shutting it off. So that's why we have this structure within there, is to actually create this construct to start shutting off the draw from the dividend when we no longer need it because oil prices recover. And so that's the reason that we've got more to it than just a straight POMV.
Mr. Chairman?
We got a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I'm reading this chart correctly, so I can, depending upon what the barrel, the price is, and assuming we have a $4 billion operating/capital, we can get it off of a POMV, I mean, from what I see from your chart. So I guess I still don't understand why we need to make all these other changes you're talking about and make it so there's only $1,000 by, because the yellow, if I understand, is the 5.25% you're filling up in that hole. Is that, maybe I need to start there, is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, that's correct. The yellow is the full POMV draw. The blue is current revenues from oil and gas, and the green is other revenues.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
This may take me a few to try to get myself here. So this is based on the fall revenue forecast, based on the barrels that are forecast in the fall and the price?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's correct.
So the way I read this, we're not that far off. I mean, maybe I'm missing something, but again, we're about $65 for a barrel at this point. I'm pretty sure that's what the average was in the fall. And with the cuts you had at the beginning with what the Senate had said, although, I know we don't usually, Mr. Chairman, talk about them there. We don't have to have oil go that much further to be able to actually reach it by using, and maybe it's not a 5.25%, maybe that's what needs to be adjusted to make sure until the price goes up that we would still be able to have sustainable budget without necessarily making all the changes that are in this bill.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we're at about $55 a barrel right now, not 65. Our average is less than 50 for the year right now. And there's really no one forecasting oil going above 55 or 60 into the future. Even if you look out a year in the future prices, it's about $57. So we're not looking at 65 and climbing. And really the only thing that I missed that's being driven by the fall forecast, it's not long-term oil price, because this is, like I said, this isn't a time series. This is just at various prices what the cost of transportation and lifting costs and capital costs in the field, which tells us how much we actually collect at any given price, and an estimate of what our revenues are right now from other sources. So it's a spot in time. It's not a time series. But that's just to make sure that we're clear. It doesn't really go to your point. We're also recognizing here that the yellow bar is I can't really tell. Does that include the dividend? That's the full draw, isn't it?
I believe that is net the dividend.
Oh, net the dividend. Okay. So this would be net the $1,000 dividend, not a $2,000 dividend.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe we could get, you know, what the actual dollar amount, not just for a 5.25% of market value, but maybe 6.5, just to kind of get an idea how much, you know, if you're capping it, what the actual dollar amount. Sometimes on these charts it's a little hard to tell exactly going across when you've just got millions sitting over here on that. That would, a chart like that would be helpful.
If you could
through the chair,
we'll pass that out to the committee.
Well, and just to put a number on it for discussion today, if at $60 oil, which is higher than we are now, but kind of where we kind of think the prices are going to stabilize, and current spending, we're looking at about a $700 million gap with all revenues at $60 oil, and that at a $1,000 dividend. And at a $2,000 dividend, we're looking at about a $1.3 billion gap that we would have to fill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
And just as a point, this was actually the draw limit that we're coming on to now is really something that was developed in Senate State Affairs last year, which I think was the hearing process at its best. I mean, it's a really elegant solution that was developed within the hearing process, and something that the administration readily adopted because we think it got us to where we needed to go. So the draw limit reduces the percent of market value draw by, on a dollar-for-dollar basis, once the unrestricted general fund production taxes and royalties exceed $1.2 billion. So once we're getting $1.2 billion from our severance tax and our royalties, that after that, we start reducing the draw from the dividend on a dollar-for-dollar basis on any additional oil and gas taxes and royalties that we receive, and essentially slowly turning off the dividend draw as revenues increase from oil and gas production.
You got a question from Co-Chair Seaton?
When you talk about this formula, production taxes and royalties, are you including the liability that we are incurring from production tax credits?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Seaton. No, the oil and gas. This is severance tax without credits. And it has the per barrel credit, which is embedded within the tax structure, but not the net operating loss credits or anything like that.
Follow up.
Thank you. So, to have this mechanism work, we would be limiting our revenues, although our liabilities from a tax credit system could be vastly increasing depending upon what the expenditures were decided on by not the state but by third parties.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Seaton, that's correct. Is the money to pay the credits would come out of the available monies for appropriation, and would not slow when the trigger occurred. The $1.2 billion is actual severance taxes, actual royalties without a deduct for credits.
Hold on. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm trying to figure out, you know, turning off revenue to the state and having basically credits running us into deficits I think that that needs to be factored in here, because the legislature is going to have to make decisions on expenditures, and if we leave out something as big as future potential liabilities as we oil prices increase, we would expect more activity, more expenditures, creating more liabilities from us. And if we're not calculating that into the formula, I think we need to look at that as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
You got a question from Representative Pruitt?
Question on that. So, I mean, do you determine the 1.2, the production taxes and royalties there? Are credits determined when you put out the source book? Do you say that revenues from oil and gas taxes and royalties, do you back out credits, anything other than the per barrel credit? Or are credits deemed as a UGF expenditure in eyes of the state in terms of the Department of Revenue, OMB, whoever? Are they deemed a UGF expenditure or a piece of what you would put out from the source book as revenue?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, if you look at different places within the book, you'll find it both. You'll see be able to calculate it both ways. The credits against liability, you know, particularly the net operating loss credits, we actually, because those are a revenue reduction, not an expenditure, they would show as less revenue from oil and gas tax receipts. The credits against liability show as just a separate line item.
Thank you.
We had a question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you, through the chair. You know, I guess my concern is this makes us, you know, so at some point, if we ever get to $70 a barrel again, that's when we don't get to use the extra state revenue, and I think that makes us pretend that we don't have $1 billion deferred maintenance obligation. Makes us pretend that we're not $30 million behind in school funding from where we were just 2 years ago. And I just want to see whether it makes us pretend we're going to get to $70 a barrel. So when in your forecast do we get to $70 a barrel, your price forecast?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, I'd have to go back and look. But the real long-term real value for oil we show is $70. But I'm not sure when we actually cross that price point. It's several years from now. But I'd have to go back and pull the forecast to know right offhand.
Through the chair.
Hello.
So I guess, you know, to folks who want to want that kind of budget between $70 and $110 a barrel, that flat level isn't going to happen. Not going to happen this year or next year. It's as I recall, it's at least 5 years before we ever get to $70 a barrel. Is that fair?
Through the chair, I think that's reasonable. Yes.
Thank you. Please proceed. Yeah.
So going to slide 31, we see the net effect of this turning off of the revenues from oil and gas, and it gradually reduces the amount drawn from the earnings reserve as oil revenues increase. It stabilizes unrestricted general fund revenue through a range of oil prices, and it actually grows the fund more by producing this feedback loop, this four times draw loop. And I'm going to talk about it a little bit now, even though it doesn't come up for a couple of slides. But when the earnings reserve exceeds four times the annual draw, POMV draw, there's a provision that says the money then gets deposited, the extra money gets deposited back into the corpus of the fund. So essentially that feedback loop becomes the inflation proofing mechanism for the corpus of the fund. And so as this draw would shrink as oil prices rise, your earnings reserve would grow faster and you'd hit that feedback loop quicker, feeding more money back into the corpus of the fund. And of course, as the corpus of the fund grows, your 5.25% draw increases because it's it's a greater value of the fund. And so it kind of it creates this loop where eventually the fund starts to grow at a faster rate because you do it. It does restrict revenues early on, but we modeled this, like I said, to squeeze as much out of it as we can. We didn't do this to restrict it more. We squeezed as much as we could. And quite frankly, the $1.2 billion was a compromise that we made with Ledge Finance, because we kind of thought $1 billion was about as much as we could get, and Ledge Finance thought we'd get $1.2 billion, and we remodeled it and said, okay, yeah, we could squeeze $1.2 billion. But there's only so much money in the system, and we're trying to get as much out and protect the total system as we possibly can. Representative Gary, you're absolutely right. This does not allow for a capital program. It doesn't allow for many other things, and frankly, that's going to have to be generated with other revenues. It's not going to. There's not enough money in here to cover that plus expenditures. Slide 32. So the sustainable dividend formula, and the part that is probably the greatest interest to the public at large. What we need to do is not only what we've talked about so far, stabilized cash flow for services, we also have to create a stable dividend. So the bill itself allows a guaranteed $1,000 per person dividend for the first 2 years, so for fiscal year 18 and 19. And then after that, it would be based on 20% of the unrestricted general fund royalties and 20% of the 5.25% POM percent of market value draw. Those two would be combined together to create the total amount of the funds available for the dividend in any given year. And when we model it, if we have the modeling tomorrow, we'll show that it creates a dividend that just kind of fluctuates around that $1,000 range through the life of the 24 years of modeling that we did. Slide 33, now we can step back into this inflation-proofing transfers, the 4x draw that we talked about. Currently, the statutes provide for the legislature to make an inflation-proofing transfer to the corpus of the earnings reserve, just a direct appropriation to the corpus of the fund. And that's necessary to keep the fund sufficient to meet the cash draws, to keep the buying power of the fund in place. And a substantial amount of the value of the fund right now is attributed to the inflation proofing that's occurred over the years. But in order for this draw, for the Permanent Fund Protection Act to function, we need to make sure that the earnings reserve account has enough money to meet the draw on any given year. And so what we've said is we won't make that feedback loop to the fund until we have 4x the amount of the draw in the earnings reserve. That allows us to have, as Representative Guerra asked earlier, multiple years of bad returns. We still have enough money in the earnings reserve to cover that for several years before it would impact the amount of money that would be available for funding the dividend and for funding other government expenditures. So 4x the draw is the number that we came up with. We coupled that with a 3-year review period, so you're always reviewing it before your 4x draw would be gone, essentially giving us a chance to take corrective action if we needed to before the fund was fully depleted.
Mr. Chair,
we've got a question from Representative Pruitt.
Do you have an idea, under the current scenario, how long it would take to potentially get to that point? And then, if we were to get at that point, and I know it's all speculation based on what we currently see from in terms of returns, would you expect that would be an ongoing scenario where that money was going in? I mean, again, it's back to how do we grow the fund with the fact that we're potentially asking to utilize the fund.
Through the chair, Representative, I will have to bring that back to you. I haven't seen it modeled with the new revenue forecast yet. So. Slide 34. It's just a statement of more as much as anything else that timing matters. And so that's why we've got the 3-year review to give ourselves the feedback, the chance to look at something before it got away from us. There is an issue of what's the effective date for this to occur. It's more of a budgetary issue than a issue of the Permanent Fund Protection Act. But in the governor's bill, they show it as a FY 17 immediate effective date, which would create a FY 17 draw, and it would allow for a repayment of the draw from the CBR this year, and then would also then have the FY 18 draw occur next year. Now, there's one thing that's kind of an accounting anomaly, I guess, more than anything else, or a quirk in statutory in the statutes that occurred in the FY 16. And I may get so deep in this that I lose everybody, and if I do, I'll just come back to it later. But we'd always forward funded the dividend payment. And so, for instance, the dividend payment for FY 16 was actually funded in the FY 15 budget. In the FY 16 budget, we stopped forward funding the dividend. And so in the FY, so we didn't forward fund a dividend for the FY 17 budget. And instead, we funded the FY 17 dividend in the FY 17 budget. So although the dividend got paid every year, if you look at the dividend transfer, there's a hole in FY 16. It doesn't show a transfer for the dividend in FY 16 because we went from a forward funding process to a current year funding process. And so when you see some of the slides, you're going to see different numbers for what the dividend balance was in given years. And part of that is Ledge Finance and OMB follow the statutory provisions, which is that transfer didn't occur in FY 16. But if you look at the permanent funds records, they follow the statutory requirement that they transfer. So they transferred it as of June 30th. We didn't book it until July 1, and so they showed as an FY, you know, they showed in a different fiscal year than we do. And so you'll see a little bit of difference in the numbers, but I guarantee you, once the dividends are paid, everybody's numbers are exactly the same. It's just a matter of how it transitioned in that one year. So just kind of a heads up, if you start seeing some differences in the base numbers, that's what caused that difference. And just real briefly, conclusion for the Permanent Fund Protection Act, we really believe that what we've presented here will sustainably provide billions to the general fund into the future, into perpetuity, when they're needed, but will not make a draw from the fund in years where the fund revenues are not needed. It preserves the dividend program at a new but sustainable rate. And it stabilized the budget to give investors, I think, more confidence in the future of the state of Alaska, which is that investor confidence that fixing of the fiscal situation is something that the private sector has told us is critical in their decision making when they'll invest in the state. Because as long as we leave a hole in the budget, as long as we have a fiscal plan that's not complete, there will always be concern about whether they're going to be the entity that is tagged with filling that hole. And so the private sector has made very clear they want to see a complete fiscal plan in order to be assured of start making significant investments in the state again. And the permanent fund is really the only way that you can get to that final solution. There's not enough money in cuts and other revenues to get us to that solution without using earnings of the permanent fund to get there. Slide 37 is just a very quick sectional analysis. We can walk through it in about 2 minutes and then open it up for questions. Section 1 is the review framework, the every three-year review. Section 2 is royalties, adjusting that royalties to the principal back to just the constitutional 25%. Section 3 is conforming amendments. Section 4 is the 5.25% of market value draw and the draw limit, the $1.2 billion feedback loop on the draw limit. Section 5 is conforming amendments. Section 6 is appropriations from the earnings reserve to the general fund in principal, primarily the 4x draw calculation. Section 7 is the dividend appropriation, the 2020 formula. Skipping down to Section 10, it's the guarantee of a $1,000 dividend in years 18 and 19. The slide says 17 and 18, but it's actually 18 and 19. Section 13 is the repeal of the language on the CBR subaccount, and that's the one that has limited our ability to invest that account more aggressively. And then Section 15 is the immediate effective date. And so that's the Permanent Fund Protection Act in the short version.
That's easy. We got it. Thank you. We'll open it up to questions here. Really quickly, if I could, I'm a spreadsheet guy. I love Excel.
Okay.
And so, for example, here on slide 28, you've got the calculation of how we actually calculate the POMV and which years and so forth. Either if you've got like an example of like how all these calculations work in terms of throwing in the actual numbers that we currently have and how that would, you know, equate down to the formula for how the dividends paid out and how all the different formulas are connected there. If I could either see some example or if I could just see the spreadsheet that you use to model, I can go through that and make things more clear for me. So with that, do other folks have questions here? We've got a question from Representative Guerra.
Commissioner, just following up on Representative Foster's sort of spreadsheet thing, when I asked you to project out 10 years what the dividend would be under the various different dividend plans that you had listed on one of the PowerPoint pages,
mm-hmm.
if you could do that 10-year projection of the dividends under each of the various bills on one spreadsheet, that would be great too.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, we will do that. I'm not sure we've got all of those modeled yet. So we'll get you this bill first, and then we'll get you the rest as soon as we get them all modeled.
I'll just wait till you get them all.
Okay.
Thanks.
We've got a question from Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Randy, could you go back and just quickly summarize the draw limit feature and how that exactly works? Again, I just want to hear that one more time. In other words, how that works.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. Yes, the way it works is that once we're getting $1.2 billion from severance taxes and the royalties not going into the corpus of the fund, that once we hit that $1.2 billion, then for every additional dollar that we receive in oil and gas taxes and royalties, we reduce the draw from the dividend by $1. And so, if we bring in $200 million more in revenues, we would reduce them up from the draw from the dividend by $200 million.
Follow up?
Keeping in mind the issue of how the tax credits relate to that, but aside from that, is that $1.2 billion, does that happen pretty regularly, or is it not going to happen for a while, or what's your projection on that?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, we'll bring some modeling in to show where we think that's going to occur, and similar to what Representative Wilson had asked for.
Got a question from Representative Guttenberg.
Concerning modeling as well, because I think we went through this last year. We went through a lot of things last year. But the projection tax when royalties exceed a certain amount, can you go from 1.2 to 1.5 to 1.7, kind of show us what that would look like if we had raised that? Because in some ways, trying to figure out how much of an artificial spending cap that does put in.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, we can do that. It comes with a secondary calculation because in order to allow for that larger cap, we have to start at a lower starting point. And so we'd have to have less than the 5.25% draw because of the feedback loop wouldn't occur until at much higher oil prices.
Sure.
So we can model those.
We have any other questions? Got a question from Representative Grin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On slide 33, regarding the inflation proofing, can you talk to me a little bit about the process of where you landed on four times the maximum? Why not five or six or two? What's, is there a downside to having a lot in the earnings reserve? Or
Through the chair, Representative Graham, there's no downside to having it in the earnings reserve. The permanent fund invests the earnings reserve right along with the rest of the fund, so it earns at the same rate as the rest of the fund. So there's no downside in the earnings reserve having more money in it or less. We used the 4 times because we wanted to do a draw, or I mean the review, at a time something less than one gubernatorial term, because we didn't want to be in a position where the brand new revenue staff comes in and has to try and figure out, you know, do all the modeling to figure out whether the draw is right, or they make the decision right before the new governor comes in, and then the new governor is kind of has to figure out whether it's the right number. So we thought, well, if we do a 4 times draw and a 3-year review process, we'll make sure we have at least one review process in every gubernatorial term, and we'll make sure that we've got at least one extra year's revenue in the fund so that we would not deplete the fund before that 3-year time period came up if we had multiple bad years of investments.
We've got a question from Representative Pruitt and then Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, of course, you mentioned something that I thought was, I think, really important in the discussion, and that was the 5.25, saying that it was aggressive, and there's a recognition that it's aggressive. Is it appropriate to say that currently the risk in our budget resides mostly in oil taxes? Or in oil itself and the volatility? Is that an appropriate statement?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that's absolutely correct.
And so, Mr. Chair, subsequently by moving in this direction, we're shifting that risk from it being an oil more onto the permanent fund. And I guess my question is because I think that really relates to the percentage that we determine is sustainable. What pressure do we place then of putting our risk in the permanent fund of being very aggressive with that POMV number? I mean, subsequently, What is pressure does that place on the actual organization itself, you know, the drive to have to hit those numbers from the director and her staff and the people that are on the board over there?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, certainly it would change the dynamic at the Permanent Fund Corporation. There's no doubt about it, because there would be a lot more scrutiny on their level of returns on an annual basis when it was feeding directly into the budget. That being said, I don't think we're so overly aggressive that we're asking them to do something that carries too much risk or changes their process in a dramatic fashion. It just kind of uses as much revenue as we can under their existing process. But yeah, in a down year, I think they realize that they will feel more pressure, and that's gonna change the dynamics over there a little bit. But it's certainly it's something I think that was always kind of anticipated when we, no matter what kind of use of the fund, it's going to be that's going to occur. And we certainly don't want to be so concerned about that level that we, like I said, that we underutilize the fund. So.
Yeah, and just one follow-up on that. And so, and I want to make sure that I heard you correctly earlier. You do agree with the notion of giving some of the tools, specifically the procurement discussion, the tools in the hands of the permanent fund to ensure that they have the ability. I think you had agreed to that, but I wanted to make sure that I clarified that.
Through the chair, Representative, absolutely.
Okay, good. All right, thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, through the chair. Actually, you surprised me when you said the 4 times draw thing was sort of more of a political calculus, and I guess I don't understand it. So you want to have 4 times your future amount of draws in there for what's the political calculus? I don't understand it, honestly.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra. The 4 times draw wasn't the political calculus. The review, the three-year review period was, that we wanted to make sure that we had at least one review period within every gubernatorial cycle. And so the 4 years was just one more year than that in order to make sure that we wouldn't run out of money before the review occurred.
Well, good. Do we have any further questions, Representative Seaton?
Thank you. I guess inflation proofing isn't going to take place for a number of years under this scenario, and directing the additional 25% of royalties away from the permanent fund and to the general fund seems to be removing that input, which actually kind of helps with inflation proofing. So what's the calculus behind that?
To the chair, co-chair Seaton, the if the permanent fund meets their projected returns, the 6.95%, the fund will grow with inflation, even with the draw occurring. The problem being without the fund is going to continue to grow. The problem is without the inflation-proofing loop that takes the money and puts it into the corpus of the fund, eventually all those earnings get realized and would flow out of the fund. So even though there won't be that deposit back into the corpus in the first few years, we expect that the fund will still grow at a rate that would account for inflation and for the draw. You need that feedback loop at some point in time to take the money out of a place where it can be realized and eventually spent to into the corpus where it is locked up for perpetuity. And that's really what the inflation proofing has done in the past. It's just simply taken that money and said, instead of sitting in the earnings reserve, we're going to take it and put it into the corpus so that now the corpus is totally inflation proof. The fund itself will grow with inflation, but the corpus isn't inflation proofed without that feedback loop.
The bill on page 2 deletes distributable income but keeps net income. So I guess I'm trying to figure out, is there, since we're POMV, is that just to have transfers to the earnings reserve and the draw is not based upon that at all? I'm trying to figure out the calculation. Is that calculation just to determine that's in section starting on line 17 of page 2 on income?
Section 3. Could you ask the question again now that I found the spot?
I'm trying to determine, okay, we're not going to calculate distributable earnings income anymore, but we're calculating statutory net income, I guess it is, or net income. And is the sole purpose of calculating the net income to see what goes to the earnings reserve, or does that have any aspect in the, because the draw is all on a POMV, total value of the fund, and the earnings reserve. So what is the, is that the sole purpose of the net income calculation?
Yeah.
Find out what gets transferred out of the permanent fund to the earnings reserve.
Through the chair, co-chair Seaton, yes, the statutory net income calculation is to how much it moves out of the corpus of the fund and is available for appropriation. You can actually do this this entire POMV process without that particular component. We left that component in because we felt like that would give people more comfort that we were not jeopardizing the corpus of the fund. Reality is this would be a cleaner bill if you just did the POMV against the market value of the fund and just said 5.25% of the five-year average is available in a given year for appropriation and remove the entire earnings reserve process from the equation. So we left it in there to give people comfort that we hadn't done something sneaky, but the reality is that it would be better if it wasn't in there.
Follow up?
And on in the presentation on 020, page 29, I guess it is, the the POMV draw and the restriction on that. Is the purpose of that to limit future legislatures' ability to do infrastructure, to do deferred maintenance, to make those calculations so that those any monies for deferred maintenance or something has to come from other revenues sources, and that the draw is less for those?
Through the chair, co-chair Seaton, no, that's not the purpose of it. The purpose is so that we don't hyperinflate government spending in years where we have high oil prices by adding on a substantial POMV draw on top of it, and get into an overspend over a situation that we then have to pull back from at some future point in time. So it kind of flattens the amount of revenues available for government expenditures. But it really was, and it also allows, again, for that feedback loop and inflation proofing, so that if you just had a straight POMV as it's laid out here, you'll most likely have to be something substantially less than 5.25% because without that feedback loop. So it allows you to draw more, knowing that at some point in time that earnings reserve is going to build and feed back into the corpus, and it keeps you from overheating government spending in years where you might have high oil prices. And so those are the reasons behind it. The recognition is, of course, that it, as Representative Gehr brought up, that it limits how much you have available to spend in any given year, and makes it that much more difficult to do the capital programs and the deferred maintenance.
Okay, do we have any other questions of the committee? Representative Kawasaki?
Just on that point, Commissioner, thanks for being here. I mean, you mentioned, or Representative Guerra mentioned, capital budget years and things like that, but there were huge operational budget increases during that time, too. Specifically, Governor Palin and the 25th legislature thought it was deemed it right to give a $1,200 extra dividend or whatever it was called at the time. There were fuel surcharges that we added to both just about every agency. School districts were having trouble paying their heating bills. We increased money to folks that needed LIHEAP, the Low-Income Heating and Energy Assistance Program, and Alaska created its own program. So there were actually, it wasn't just inflated capital budgets. There were other things. And the reason why is because when oil was $80 or $90 a barrel, the price of energy spiked too for many consumers and Alaskans across the state. And so I hope that point is taken too.
Yeah. Okay, real good. No other questions? Seeing no other questions, our next meeting is scheduled for Friday, tomorrow, February 3rd at 1:30 p.m. At this meeting, we'll have the introduction of HB 95, the FY17 supplemental budget bill, and that will be presented by Pat Bitney and Director of the Governor's Office of Management and Budget. We will also continue our hearing on this bill, HB 61, the Governor's Permanent Fund Protection Act. And with that, we will gavel out, adjourn at 3:08 p.m. Thank you, everyone.